This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. It is the Bloomberg Big Take today. It's also the new issue of Business Week magazine just out. It's about the Trump allies such as Steve Bannon bonding with Brazil's president. And FY, Tim, it's a playbook we've seen before.
It certainly is. We've seen it from, well, President Trump himself. And joining us now is Joel Webber, editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us on the remote from Brooklyn. Also joining us is Andrew Rosati, Latin American reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us from Rio. Great to have both of you on with us. Hey, Joel, I want to start with you. What is the playbook that Bolsonaro's following specifically from President Trump right now? And it's important because, hey, there's an election coming up.
There's an election coming up, and just like the Trump playbook, you just immediately cast as much doubt on that election as you can. And he's already saying it's rigged, and you know we've got months to go until then. He's offered no actual evidence of that, but it is a tactic and one that you could probably draw a dotted line directly to Trump world, which, as Andrew Story goes into, is actually had really interesting links with Brazil. So this is not like, you know, Trump and Bolsonaro having lunch together or anything like that. It's more of like all the machinery behind Trump and all the machinery behind Bolsonaro. Those gears are increasingly linked. So, Andrew, take us into how the story came about.
Well, about 2 weeks ago, there was the Brazil version of CPAC was held in the capital, Brasilia, and former Trump spokesperson Jason Miller was among the speakers there. And leaving Brazil, he was actually detained in an airport in links to an ongoing federal inquiry in the spread of fake news and misinformation here. He didn't speak to us, but from there we started digging into these ties. And what we found is that there's a long, close relationship between Steve Bannon and Bolsonaro's oldest son, Bolsonaro's son, Eduardo, a congressman. And that relationship goes back to about 2018. And since then, you know, we're told that they're in pretty constant contact. And a lot of the tactics we're seeing from Bolsonaro's father is, you know, direct links to what we've seen in the U.S., whether they're motorcycle rallies modeled off of Sturgis and pouring doubt on voting machines. These are all echoes of things we've seen in the U.S., and what we're hearing is it comes right from Trump world.
Well, it's fascinating.
So one of the things
go ahead. Yeah, please, Joel.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, like, one of the things that I think is significant to the story, and this is something that we go into, is that, you know, the Trump world, kind of exporting of that Trumpism, it's kind of been something that's been attempted before, right, Andrew? Like, where and how did that pan out?
Well, yes, Bannon has been trying this in Europe with his so-called the movement. Some of these, far-right groups, anti-immigration groups in Europe, and it wasn't that successful. But what Bannon told us is he sees Brazil's presidential election next year as a precursor from U.S. midterms. So he and many of other such like Jason Miller, they're really throwing their weight behind this. They think Bolsonaro going against his likely opponent, former President Lula. They see this really hearken and reverberate in the U.S., just like Brexit, in their opinion, did in the 2016 update of Trump. So they're really, really, if you watch Bannon's and talk shows and podcasts, they're going on about this constantly. And they're, from what we hear, is they're in touch with not just Eduardo Bolsonaro's son, but other advisors as well.
What I find fascinating, the more I feel like there's a lot of stories that have been in Business Week that just kind of remind us that Bannon's still out there behind the scenes, to be quite honest, Andrew, that he's still doing his thing.
Yeah, definitely. And it's really interesting, too, is that, they've completely given Biden, in one way, the cold shoulder with all this. Well, even though that Biden has gone, Biden is in the White House, they've continued to follow Trump, and this has caused them a lot of tension and on the diplomatic front. President Bolsonaro was one of the last world leaders to recognize Biden's victory over Trump, and since then, what we've seen is that a very cool relationship between the two countries. And this, Brazil is one of the world's the largest country in South America, and I believe that world's sixth most populous country. So for them to have this fixation on Trump, it could cost Brazil down the line.
Well, so give us the context for everything that's happening domestically right now ahead of the election, and how this plays into the challenge that Bolsonaro is facing.
Well, right now, President Bolsonaro's poll numbers are at a record low. Inflation is rising. Hunger is spreading, as the economy is reopening, but it's a very uneven rebound here. Brazilians, by and large, are very, very frustrated and upset by Bolsonaro really, doubting the coronavirus. He had it himself. He's called it a little flu last year. And right now, for those who haven't been watching the headlines, he and his cabinet were just in the U.S. And his health minister just came down with COVID, and as did his son on the trip for the UNGA. So Brazilians are really frustrated with his antics in a lot of ways. And what Bolsonaro has done is gone full Trump. He continues to cast doubt on COVID. He continues to call his critics, of spreaders of fake news, and saying that they're trying to hijack voting machines and steal the election next year. What people fear is that he's really channeling Trump and, for a January 6th assault on the Capitol situation, and he's really laying the groundwork to, contest the election or disregard the results next year if he loses.
Speaking of that election, Lula, basically one of the most popular politicians in Brazilian history. And so what are the meeting of those two politicians? What can we expect? What's that going to look like?
Well, right now, very early polls are showing Lula cruising to a big victory right now. In Brazil, there's usually a two-round process. So, if there's not a absolute majority in the first, it would go to a second round. But right now, some polls suggest that Lula up by as much as 20 points. And it's interesting this parallel to the U.S. because Lula, not only being so popular, but he's really taking a step back and say, like Biden did in the U.S., and saying, I'm taking the pandemic seriously. And this has been the thorn in Bolsonaro's side for, much of these recent months, is that he can't shake the damage that COVID has done in his country. And many people see that as his fault. Brazil has just passed 600,000 coronavirus deaths. And so people are not willing to forget so soon.
Well, it's fascinating to make the comparison between the United States, Trump, and what's going on in Brazil. Andrew, thank you so much. Andrew Rosati, Latin American reporter on the phone in Rio, along with Jill Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week. Check out the new issue of Business Week. It is the Sooner Than You Think issue on newsstands, online at businessweek.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg terminal. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, what a week when it comes to China.
It's not over.
Again, Carol. Andy Cohen drinking game. Every time we said China, we'd all be on the floor. Oh my God, we'd be on the floor. Definitely controlling the news flow in a big way when it comes to markets, many industry. The latest we know, Tim, on our radar, once again, it's all about crypto. We talked about this with Katie.
And let's talk about it with a really great voice who joins us once again, talking all things China. A guy with so much experience in the country. Dexter Tiff Roberts, he's Mansfield Fellow at the University of Montana, also Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council's Asia Security Initiative, and our former colleague at Bloomberg Business Week. He was China Bureau Chief for years, and the author of The Myth of Chinese Capitalism, The Worker, The Factory, and The Future of the World. It came out in March of 2020. He joins us once again on the phone from Montana. Dexter, how do we make sense of this week?
Well, as you say, it's been quite a week, and we've seen it in the markets around the world. I think the bigger picture is China and its you know, its leader, Xi Jinping, is continuing with this effort to put politics back into the economy. There's a massive regulatory push throughout the tech sector. The cryptocurrency, the latest ban on cryptocurrency, it seems like there have been numerous announcements over the last couple of years from China where they've banned it and banned it again, is also saying, you know, this industry, crypto, which flaunts its freedom from regulation, has no place in China. And then, of course, we have Evergrande, and that's everything about trying to deleverage the economy. But I think at the same time also send a message to the Chinese people that the excessive wealth in some cases achieved through questionable means, which I think is rife throughout the real estate sector, is no longer tolerated.
So I wonder if you were on the ground in China right now over in Asia and you were putting your team and you're saying, okay, here's the stories I want to tell or we need to be telling when it comes to China, when it comes to Evergrande. What are the questions that we need to be asking to be really smart, especially as investors? Former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury Larry Summers telling our David Westin earlier, you know, that people should be on guard here. I don't think any of us have full transparency of what is going on in China. And that's the worry. So what are the questions? What are the things that we need to be probing to really understand stuff?
Well, I think in terms of looking at future targets from the Chinese government in different industries and businesses, anything that really touches on the livelihood of the Chinese people, they went after private education, they've gone after the big tech platforms, and now real estate as well. All these things really matter to the Chinese people. So there, we've heard about again and again about this new common prosperity campaign. This is about trying to reduce wealth inequality and at the same time have a private sector that is much more under the thumb of the government and the Communist Party. So I think an investor needs to look at what might come next, what matters to the Chinese people.
Because they've covered a lot.
Yeah, well, I think obviously private health care, we've already seen signs of that. That's another big one. I think in terms of, you know, we'll see more on the other part of the coin is anywhere where you see real extremes of wealth, you see business people making a lot of money, perhaps in industries that are destabilizing to the economy, like real estate, which has built up so much leverage. Those are all going to be targets going forward.
I've asked you this before, Tiff, but I want to ask you again, given that it's been a couple of months. What's the end game for Xi Jinping?
I think that Xi Jinping has made it abundantly clear over the last 6 months that he's actually willing to, first of all, he wants politics in control. He wants a politics in command economy. He sees the private sector as continuing to be important in creating jobs and vibrancy and innovation, but he wants it all under the thumb of the party and the government. So I think the belief is that amongst the top leadership is that they can actually continue to carry out these crackdowns, pull some of the excesses out of the economy, like the excessive leverage, get rid of some of the real extremes of wealth, and they can continue to grow. I'm not at all sure that they can pull that off.
So he wants capitalism, but not too much capitalism. And you think it's fair to say that he thinks that some of these businesses and these people involved with these businesses became just simply too powerful?
I think that's exactly what he thinks. And he's planning to, again, have a private sector that is much more answerable to the party. He wants to see, lesser extremes of wealth, and he's going to try to pull that off. That means we're going to see more crackdowns going forward.
Hey, Tiff, though, how do you reconcile what President Xi is doing right now and wanting more industries under the thumb of the Chinese government with also his ambitious agenda being leaders on, you know, in the high tech world, really building out industries, no longer being, you know, the manufacturer to the world, which they are increasingly not. But how can they do that? Can they do both?
Well, I think there's actually a real level of hubris we're seeing, and the sense that they can do both. They can become more self-reliant. They can close off their economy to some degree to the rest of the world. You know, they've basically blocked all travel in and out of China, and probably will continue until at least late next year when they have a party congress. And they've made it more difficult for, you know, companies and institutions around the world to work with China. I think they have this idea that they can go it alone. They've reached a level of power and an economy of a certain size. I'm afraid that, again, hubris here. I don't think that it really is doable.
Just in the last 30 seconds that we have, what are you watching for next? What's the next shoe to drop?
Again, I just mentioned the healthcare industry, the private healthcare industry. China refers to three big mountains that contribute to inequality in the wealth gap: housing, education, and healthcare. They've hit housing, they've hit education. I think healthcare is up next.
It's really fascinating because in many ways, that's the same three here in the United States. And the U.S. is also looking to tackle it, but obviously by different modes.
Not to mention, you know, quote unquote, rein in technology.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So it's interesting to see the different ways of doing so. Tiff, you are the best. Tiff Roberts, he is Mansfield Fellow at the University of Montana, author, former Bloomberg Businessweek China Bureau Chief. His book, The Myths of Chinese Capitalism, really plays into so much of what we're seeing right now. While the pandemic has upended, Tim, we know how we work, where we work, how bosses and workers think about the process. Sometimes process was overwhelming, boundaries between work and life were unclear. Sometimes the ability to just plow through without office distractions, not having to commute and so on, created some clarity. So I'm guessing our next guest has something to say.
It's Juliette Fund, founder and CEO of the Juliette Fund Group. And she joins us on the phone from Los Angeles. Juliette's new book is called A Minute to Think, Reclaim Creativity, Conquer Busyness, and Do Your Best Work. Juliette, thanks so much for joining us on the show. What was it about the pandemic and everything that we've been through collectively, and how it's contributed that prompted you to write this?
Well, I wrote the book before the pandemic, but the conditions of the pandemic have only amplified things that have been around in work for decades. I've been watching people for many, many years sit in tolerated misery of the day, you know, just trying to get through an earnest day's work and finding that it becomes the hardest part of their day. Unnecessary work, emails, meetings, decks, reports, a lack of connecting with meaning. These things have been around for a while before the pandemic, but the pandemic has certainly amplified them.
Well, and it's interesting. I was going to ask you, too, about your company and what you were doing pre-pandemic. Tell us a little bit more about your consultancy and training firm. And again, going back to kind of pre-pandemic and maybe how your thinking has changed a little bit.
Sure. We've been doing this work for about 10 years, and I did it 10 years before that as a speaker and consultant independently. We go into companies, we help them to reduce wasteful work and basically find more time to be thoughtful, strategic, connected. And the pandemic has been such a fascinating amplification of the worst of work in certain ways, but also has given us a little tiny taste of what's possible with giving people more liberty, that when they do have flexibility and liberty, that there are ways that work can feel different in ways that we haven't touched in a really, really long time. It's a preview of what's possible if we use this window of opportunity to redesign the way work feels.
Well, I want to follow up on that. Tim and I've had a lot of conversations with heads of companies, well-known companies, publicly traded companies. In fact, we were just talking with Fran Kasudis of Cisco Systems yesterday, who is an executive VP, chief people policy and purpose officer, and talking about hybrid work in particular. Do you think that seeing how productive people can be and maybe happier in terms of having some flexibility in how they work, that this idea of kind of being more liberal and opening up how we think about work, does it stay with us? Because there's a lot of executives who've got some pretty expensive office space who say, I want you back in the office.
Sure. We have to look at both populations of the pandemic evenly and fairly. There has been a population that's tasted a little bit of liberty and they're starting to realize that work can feel different with the freedom that they've been given. But there's also an enormous percentage of people for whom work has gotten worse in the sense that they've lost any semblance of boundaries that they had before. They used to have a little bit of separation maybe between work and life, and now it's just shuffled like a deck of cards, and there is no separation. They don't know how to turn on or off the Zoomaholic Zoomathon all day long has literally expanded to 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. So it's unsustainable, and we have to address both sides of that.
Okay, here in New York on Wall Street, it's, you know, just 20 minutes before 5 roughly. What's one tip you can give us to help us go into the weekend and sort of enter the and stay unplugged?
Sure. Entering the weekend, we want to, first of all, have a way to close the door on work. It's very, very difficult. One technique is to take all of your work-related things and make them put them inside some sort of physical compartment, a desk, a drawer, a dresser, so that you can't visually keep seeing them through the time when you're supposed to be disconnected. Another incredibly simple technique, although it sounds a little lighthearted, is if you just say out loud in front of the people that you love, I call this trapping yourself in a promise. You say, well, I'm done for the weekend. No more work for me this weekend. And once you say out loud that you've made a commitment that there'll be a boundary between work and leisure,
right,
it's really hard to go sneak that sip of the laptop. You can do this even alone. If you live alone, you can have a boundary buddy and just text each other and say work is over.
Really wonderful. Hope we can get you back in the future because some really great tips. And you are someone who works with Spotify, Nike, Costco, Cisco, the food Cisco, ESPN, so many companies. Juliette Funt, founder and CEO of Juliette Funt Group. Her book is A Minute to Think, Reclaim Creativity, Conquer Business, Busyness, and Do Your Best Work.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right. We've just got about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. We are near our highs of the session on this Friday. And what was been quite a week, Tim, you and I were having some fun about, like, it's like Monday never happened.
It's pretty wild to see that. I mean, if we take a look at where stocks are for the week, we're, you know, looking like we're going to end the S&P 500 higher by 0.6%.
A little bit of a gain there.
All right,
let's get to it. Time for the drive to the close. Chad Garcia is with us, VP, Lead Portfolio Manager at Ave Maria Funds, Co-Portfolio Manager of the Ave Maria Growth Fund. That fund, by the way, up 17% year to date, putting it in the 45th percentile compared with other funds in the category. That's according to our data, up 33% over the past 1 year. He joins us on the phone from Florida. Chad, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, this market environment, how would you describe it?
Well, this week's been pretty volatile, but you know, mostly flat.
Right? Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it is. It is. Although it is nice to be up at the end of the week, given where we started.
Yeah, it's always nice to be up on a Friday, right?
Yeah.
Does that tell you, though, that, Chad, that you know, buying the dip was the right move here?
I was buying the dip in my portfolios. So
it was enough of a dip for you to buy.
I'm happy that I did.
Well, I think that's the question that a lot of people had, is this a precursor to something bigger that's going to come?
Well, I mean, the what we were buying was, I think, was a little bit more effective than the general economy, and that was enough to make me buy. With respect to, is this a precursor of something more to come? I mean, I think that the earnings ended strongly. It looks like the coronavirus is dissipating. The hospitalizations for the U.S. is about 80,000, which is down from the recent peak of 100,000. So
right.
I think the Fed's seeing the economy ending the year strong, you know, to the point where they're gonna announce a taper in November and probably start that in December.
Hey, let's go back to, I love talking about people or with people who are managing funds. You mentioned you were buying on some of the declines that we saw. Obviously, there were probably some more interesting entry points. What in particular were you buying?
We don't disclose our buys until after they've been publicly disclosed.
Okay.
But I can tell you some interesting stocks that we're definitely looking at.
Yeah.
Well, the biggest, so you mentioned that the co-portfolio manager of the Growth Fund, I'm also portfolio manager of the Focus Fund, which is in the top quartile year to date. And our largest position is eDreams, which is an online travel agency in Europe. And this is interesting for a couple of reasons. number one is that they only focus on leisure travel, and leisure travel is going to rebound much quicker than the overall travel market because business is going to take a little bit to recover. And we've already seen that. They've announced their August bookings, and their August bookings were up 28% over the 2019 pre-COVID numbers. And so the consumers, whether it's in the U.S. or Europe, they want to travel. And so that's exciting. And then the other exciting part of this business is that they're switching from a transaction model to a subscriber model, where the subscribers get discounts on trips that they book using them, and they pay a fee up front for that privilege. And currently their subscribers are up to 1.5 million subscribers. Yeah. Which is exciting for them.
It's been on quite a run. It's up about 95% so far this year. But you think there's more opportunity, more move to the upside?
I think that at 1.5 million subscribers, this is where they're at. These subscribers are paying around 60 euros a year. Just the cash flow stream from those subscribers alone, I think, values us at 10 to 20 euros a share, and mm-hmm. you get the rest of the business for free.
And the ADRs in the U.S. trade under the ticker EDDRF, just in case anybody was wondering.
Yes, the ADRs in the U.S. aren't that liquid, so it would be one that you'd probably want to buy in the primary market.
Okay, good to know.
Chad, another stock our producer is telling us that you have as a pick. HEICO has about $16 billion in market cap. Airplane parts, take us into it.
Yes, HEICO is also related to travel, like eDreams. This one's going to be a little slower to recover, given that they're exposed to the travel industry overall. But you know, HEICO has two businesses. The largest is an aftermarket parts business for commercial planes. And what they do is they put themselves in a duopoly position with the original equipment manufacturers. They charge about 30% less than the original equipment manufacturers, and they capture about a third of the market. And the secret sauce is the ability to sell parts for airplanes is governed by the FAA. It has to approve each part that goes on an airplane. And HEICO's advantage is that they can get about 500 new parts through the FAA approval process per year, which is multiples higher than anybody else. And so what they do is they allow the airlines an alternative part supplier to the original equipment manufacturers, and they save the airline money. So while HEICO is going to be a little slower to recover than eDreams because it's exposed to the overall travel market, it should do decently well because, you know, in this challenging environment, the airlines are going to be looking to save money any way they can.
Hey, just quickly, just got about 30 seconds left. API Group is another one, an industrial maintenance company. It's up about 15% this year, $4.7 billion market cap, excuse me. Just quickly, your take on that and why you think it's a buy.
Well, it trades about an 8%, 7-8% free cash flow yield. And for a company that has an organic growth rate, this company has grown organically about 7% per year for the decade prior to COVID. And then on top of that organic growth, they are able to roll up mom and pop small businesses paying between four to six times EBITDA, mm-hmm. which further accelerates that growth. They just bought Chubb Fire and Safety, which is a large business that was an orphan company out of a Carrier, a public company. Mm. That gets them into multiple markets around the world.
Right.
Blackstone Group was also bid for that business, but decided to back API's bid mm-hmm. by investing in API through convertible preferred.
Got it.
I think Blackstone's going to open up their portfolio of real estate holdings in a lot.
Well, good to know. And unfortunately, we've got to run. Chad Garcia over at Ave Maria Funds joining us on the phone.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.